This podcast is brought to you by the Center for Urban and Racial Equity, an organization that cultivates pathways to racial equity, justice, collective healing, and well-being. Welcome to Embodied Justice, presented by the Center for Urban and Racial Equity. Join me, your host, Dr. Judy Lubin, as we explore the impact of trauma on leadership and change-making, and pause to celebrate our resilience while we build our personal and collective toolkits for healing and well-being. Each episode brings innovative insights and practical tools to empower and enlighten. Ready to make a difference? Welcome to the Path of Embodied Justice. Let's dive into the episode. I'm so excited to welcome you to the Embodied Justice podcast. For our first interview, I sat down with Michelle C. Johnson, and all I can say is wow. If I could sum up this conversation in one sentence, it would be this: activism is sacred work. This whole conversation is what change facilitators and change makers need to hear. Our healing practices to recover from personal and collective trauma are sacred. Those practices become even more important in moments of crisis so that we're not consumed with overwhelm. Let's dive into this episode and hear all of the nuggets of wisdom from Michelle C. Johnson. Today, I'm thrilled to have Michelle C. Johnson, a race equity trainer, social justice warrior, intuitive healer, yoga teacher, and author. Michelle's work focuses on the intersections of justice, spirituality, and healing, aiming to create spaces for individual and collective transformation. She has led dismantling racism work in many settings and has 2 decades of practice as a clinical social worker. Michelle is the author of impactful books such as Skill in Action, Radicalizing Your Yoga Practice to Create a Just World, We Heal Together, Rituals and Practices for Building Community and Connection, and Finding Refuge, Heart Work for Healing Collective Grief. Michelle also hosts the Finding Refuge podcast, where she engages with a wide array of guests to explore themes of social justice, spiritual healing, and collective liberation. Michelle joins us to delve into the themes of reckoning and rest, exploring how we navigate the challenges of our times with resilience and grace. Michelle's insights come from a rich background of activism, healing practices, and spiritual inquiry, making her a uniquely powerful voice on these critical topics. Join us as we engage in a profound conversation about finding healing, building community, and fostering connection in pursuit of a more just and compassionate world. Michelle, welcome to the Embodied Justice podcast.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here with you. Thanks for the invitation.
I'm so excited, Michelle, to be in conversation with you today. Your story, your background, your journey is one that I find inspiring and I think really speaks to our audience of Black change makers. And I'd love if you could tell us how you arrived at this point where you weave yoga and spirituality into social justice and change making work.
Yeah, thanks for the question. This feels like a big question. I'll say that. Like, how did we arrive where we are is a big question. But I have a few answers to it. And one is some of what you mentioned in the introduction, that I've been a racial equity educator for many, many years, over 2 decades, and worked in community and with institutions and organizations. And about halfway through my tenure as a racial equity educator, I ended up going to yoga teacher training. I was a clinical social worker at the time in a nonprofit, but also had a private practice. And I went to yoga teacher training so that I could integrate yoga as a healing modality in my clinical social work practice as I worked with clients individually and within groups. And when I entered yoga teacher training, I had been practicing yoga for many years, but I realized, or maybe was reminded, that the industry of yoga, westernized industry of yoga and wellness, is as exclusive as any other system when we think about the system of racism and white supremacy and the hierarchy of bodies. And yet I was in a healing setting. I mean, many people go to a yoga practice or something like yoga, a spiritual practice, for their own healing and maybe to contemplate how do we heal this planet and how do we engage in healing with one another and relationship to one another. So it caused some dissonance, and I had a lot of questions about how a healing modality such as yoga or a spiritual path could be as exclusive as every other institution I interacted with, as I think about proximity to power and identities. And that intersection of my justice work and racial equity work and organizing work and activism, and then deepening my spiritual practice and also thinking about the application of it in community, that intersection ignited something inside me that led to, I think, a fire, right, inside me that led to my writing my first book, Skill in Action, as you mentioned. And the other thing that I feel like is connected to how I landed where I am right now is in all of my work, be that racial equity work or within the context of an hour-long yoga and meditation practice or within the context of a retreat or working with clients through intuitive healing and helping them to deepen their intuition, or thinking about the work that I do in community around healing ourselves and healing the planet and remembering how interconnected we are and understanding our place in the ecosystem. I feel like the thread throughout all of the work I've ever done is healing. It is how do we come back into wholeness and how can we engage in a potent healing process, not just for self, but because I'm in relationship with you and all beings. So in service to something bigger than me. And perhaps that's humanity for me, or perhaps that is spirit for me, or perhaps that's an understanding that I'm nature and part of the ecosystem. So healing is how I got here. And I've just engaged in it in different ways as I've evolved in my own learning and practice, and as I've interacted with people who sit with the same questions and joys and sorrows that I have in response to all that is happening in our world. And the other thing I'll mention about how I came to be in this way, it would be strange for me not to mention my mother, Clara, and my grandmother, Dorothy, and my ancestors. Dorothy and Clara are beings. Clara is a living ancestor. She's still here. And Dorothy transitioned in 2017. And they have influenced me in so many ways and taught me, really, they were the first people to share with me what it means to be of service, what it means to believe in something bigger than self, myself, what it means to be devoted to a practice, what it means to work to align our values with our actions. My grandmother and mother, what it means to pray, right? Or offer blessings because we recognize the disconnection or the sorrow and we were impacted by it and moved by it in some way. So I just want to call them in because they shaped who I am. And this urge, this drive, this call to work to decrease the suffering on the planet, my own and others.
Thank you so much, Michelle, for sharing who you are, your journey, calling in Dorothy and Clara and your ancestors. And I wanted to start there with our ancestors. In We Heal Together, you write about the connection between ancestors and healing past traumas and the traumas of today. And there was a line in the book and where you mentioned, you said, "I had to hold pain bigger than me." And you talked about this recovery process and what ancestral traumas we have to uncover to heal. And I'd love if you could unpack that for us a bit in terms of the importance of calling in our ancestors, why this is really intergenerational work when we talk about undoing systems of oppression and the healing that we have to do individually and collectively, and the role that our ancestors play in that healing.
Yeah, I love this question. The part you're talking about in We Heal Together is in some ways a follow-up to the introduction in Finding Refuge, my second book. And the introduction in Finding Refuge is about the moment I heard that George Zimmerman had been acquitted for the murder of Trayvon Martin and what came undone inside of me in that moment. Not that racism was new, not that my Blackness was new, but there was something, and I've talked to many other Black folks about this, that happened in that moment that speaks to collective trauma and how it's held in our bodies and what shifted on the planet. I think about the murder of George Floyd in the same way, which was many years later, but that moment of something shifted in the collective consciousness. I don't know about the impact of that long term, but something happened in that particular moment. And in We Heal Together, I recount a bit more about the story of coming undone and what it means, as you name, to enter a process of recovery, and name that recovery is not an easy process. And it's an ongoing process, just as healing is. This is how I think about it. And this pain that I was responding to that felt bigger than me the moment I heard about the acquittal of George Zimmerman, it felt like it was centuries old. I mean, it felt like, I don't know what's happening to me in this moment. There is something moving through me that is bigger than my body, and I'm not sure what to do with it. It was that kind of moment, and pivotal in many ways, because the grief felt so profound. It felt so deep. It felt so old. It felt unresolved. It felt like, you know, ancestral grief and an ancestral call for healing to happen. It felt like that as well. And for people to experience that, to feel it, to listen to it, that something's deeply wrong if things like what happened to Trayvon Martin or what happened to George Floyd and many others. I mean, there are many names, right? And people, there's something deeply misaligned about that. And it illuminates the way we are not in our humanity, that we aren't remembering we are related to one another. And that, I think, is connected to heartbreak for me and ancestral heartbreak. Like, enough is enough is enough is how that moment felt. As I reflected on it in the moment, I thought, I'm in pieces. I don't know how I'm going to piece myself back together. That's how I felt in that particular moment. But by the time I wrote about this and We Healed Together, I'd had some time to reflect and process and heal myself. Not that I'm done, but there had been some time and space and an understanding that what was happening was ancestral trauma. And I was just talking about this the other night, that I'm thinking about what is happening in Gaza and to Palestinian people a lot. And this is not a new thought for me. I've actually been in relationship with folks who have raised my consciousness about what was happening there long ago. And of course, for many people, this may be a newer conversation or newer awareness, but it's old for me. And I was talking about how that in my body, I have some memory of the patterns of violence that are being experienced there. Now, we know multiple genocides are happening across the globe. So in my body, there is some memory ancestrally of the patterns of harm and violence that are playing out right now across the globe, right? Through violence, through harm, through genocide, through attempted annihilation of entire groups of people, through starvation, through all of the different means that are being used. And so I was honoring that, like, I understand this somewhere in my DNA. And yet I was like sitting outside with my partner having a conversation. And I had this like this, it was, it's so much, I have a lot of dissonance around that of like, there is the ancestral memory of what this feels like from my folks being enslaved, but also it's playing out right now. So I understand that in my body. And then what does it mean that I'm sitting here on my deck having a conversation as this is happening? And it just made me think about, to your point, intergenerational trauma and the excavation process that needs to happen for us to understand that trauma and the impact of that trauma as that trauma is playing out right now. And in some way, my nervous system is responding to that. In some way, my nervous system was like, you should not be sitting here having this conversation while you are safe on your deck right now, while this is happening, because your body remembers what it's like for this to happen. And so to me, that just complicates the recovery process. And that, you know, as I've written about in that dynamic of dissonance and where I am now and a memory, and also for many of us, what is unknown, right? This uncovering that we have to do, an excavation, often it does come through some sort of traumatic experience that we experience or we witness or we're reminded of. And it means uncovering things that are painful. It means reckoning. It means being in that place of confusion. It means grieving. It may mean having some family conversations, right, to try to better understand. It may mean connecting with ancestors who have transitioned or attempting to do that to try to understand what we need to know now so we can heal. But I think the final thing I'll say about recovery here is that what I have been conditioned to do, if I think about dominant cultural norms and hierarchies and systems, is to bypass a recovery process, is to act as if everything is okay. And all that does is replicate more trauma and create more grief and create more harm. And that's the other part of And We Heal Together, that we can't bypass the trauma, ancestral and present day, and the trauma we're anticipating. And the trauma we may not even have words for, but we know because our nervous systems feel it, because we are attuned to one another in that way, even if we're not experiencing that particular trauma. I think it's important for us, for me, for people, the collective, to understand that the recovery process is the pathway toward healing, which means acknowledgement of trauma, that we can't get to the healing place without acknowledging what has been wounded, or the way we've wounded one another, or the heartbreak. And yet there's a tendency to want to bypass because ancestral trauma feels uncomfortable. It feels massive, bigger than the body, as we've named. Sometimes we don't know what to do with it. And we're also in a culture where I'm moving around with this ancestral trauma, and also a thousand other things are happening in any given moment that might need my attention, which I think leads to more misalignment, actually, and distraction, and a lack of wholeness, and instead fragmentation. So I just think we have to lean in to this recovery process, and we don't have to do it on our own. I mean, this is where community comes into place, where we lean on each other to recover, to acknowledge the collective trauma, the collective consciousness, and the way it shifted. And in so many ways, a recovery process is also a dream for what could happen in the future, right? And so we lean into community as well to dream about what is possible, or what has happened, and what is possible now, and what do we need to remember. So it's also in the spirit of that recovery is healing, but it's also this dreaming process about some other way or state of being. That's how I think about it.
I wanted to take a quick second to not only thank you for tuning in, but also to share more about the initiative that sparked this limited series. Leading racial equity and justice work can take a toll on us mentally, physically, and spiritually. The Embodied Justice Program centers the well-being of Black changemakers through programming that builds community and provides space to explore practices that support our collective healing, personal transformation, joy, and sustainability. This program not only includes the podcast, but also free virtual workshops or online gatherings, as we call it, and practical tips and inspiration sent straight to your inbox. We're excited to announce a 3-day in-person retreat, August 1st through 4th, in the beautiful mountains of Georgia. Join me and Sean J. Moore, also known as the Mindful Rebel, as we help you develop practices around rest, cultivating inner peace, and providing space for you to realign your passion and purpose behind your work. If you're a Black change maker leading racial equity in communities and organizations, this program is here just for you. To learn more, visit embodiedjustice.org and sign up for the newsletter to learn when our online gatherings begin and to apply to the retreat. Limited scholarships are also available. The link is in the description. Now let's get back to the interview.
As I was reading your book, and you talked about how you felt during when the verdict came out, with the George Zimmerman verdict, it took me back to that moment. You know, we all have these moments in our lives where we know exactly where we were when this huge monumental event happened. And that was one of those moments for me. I remember being in the movie theater on a date, and a friend of mine texted me the verdict. And I remember feeling like I had come out of myself. And I remember the sense of rage that I felt at that moment. And it's this collective experience, and you named it so well that it's not just the grief that we're experiencing now, it's ancestral grief. It was the familiarity of that moment of our humanity as Black people being dismissed, being discarded. And I remember what I said at that moment. And I understood the rage. I understood why things were going to burn that night because I felt it. And that we are living through so many of those moments, even as you talked about Gaza. And how do we stay in a place of healing? And that's the question that I'm struggling to get out is like, how, when we are in these moments of constant assault and trauma and violence and reliving of these experiences, change makers or facilitators that are trying to hold space for other people that may be experiencing trauma, violence, systemic neglect, and oppression, where do we find healing, refuge, balance? And I have to say, it was the last year I was on a retreat with Michelle and Rashid Hughes, and the retreat was called Finding Rest and Refuge. And I don't know that I was looking for a retreat, but I found the two of you. And the other day I was saying that retreat found me. I don't know, I was looking for the retreat, but I was feeling so much exhaustion and needing rest and hadn't even thought about the concept of refuge. And so when I saw rest and refuge, that resonated so deeply with my soul and what I need and needed, and what I know so many of us that are doing this change work of trying to heal systems and create healing communities and spaces is, how do we find this sense of rest and refuge even as we are experiencing this continual trauma and violence, and oftentimes are the ones that are responding and responding to those moments to enable others to find some sense of healing and rest and even to grieve, right? Which I think is such an important part of your work, that grieving is this continual process that we're all engaged in as well.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for sharing about your experience and recovering memory and where you were and the response, and sharing about the rage you felt in that particular moment you were talking about. And this question about, you know, as space holders, as change makers, as facilitators, I think your question is, how do we stay in the healing? How do we create the healing? How do we offer the healing to ourselves and others? How do we create space for healing to happen, is how I heard your question. And I want to say, one, I want to, you know, offer a deep bow of gratitude to anyone who is holding space for transformation right now, in the middle of the world being on fire in many, many ways. Like, I don't even know how. I mean, I'm a facilitator. Like, how do we do it? I have some thoughts in response to your question, but I just want to, it's often I find that it is a challenge to explain to folks who are not facilitators or space holders for change what it is that I or people like me do. And I don't know that people understand, unless people are in it or participate a lot and are facilitated, I don't know that people understand the gravity of what we are being asked to hold at this particular time, and like how things pile on. It's like one thing and then another thing happens and another, and all of it's coming into our spaces. So I just want to offer that too, that it's not easy work. I mean, we're being asked to hold trauma, as you named, we're being asked to hold grief, we're being asked to hold chaos. We're in the middle of a, you know, context where there is an endless amount of chaos and trauma and activation, and people's nervous systems are overwhelmed. And then they're all coming together in a space, and we're supposed to, as a facilitator, a change maker, or space holder, hold that space and hold ourselves in it and create a space for change. I just want to honor how difficult that is. It's a difficult task, and thank all the people who are doing it. Because in my experience as a facilitator, which I have been one for many, many years, of change in many different contexts, in the last, I would say, 5 years, it has intensified. The feeling in the space as people come together is like intense within the first 2 minutes or even before they get there. And I'm feeling into the space, or like when 2 people out of the 10 arrive, I feel like, okay, it's on now. Like I'm feeling what people are feeling also because I'm human and having an experience of being activated myself and overwhelmed myself. And to me, that points to the healing. Like, how do we stay in it? If I am not taking care of myself in the midst of continual chaos, and I am supposed to go in and hold space for change and hold people and their stuff and their response to the chaos, there's no way for me to do that if I am not caring for myself in some way. I'm not talking about perfection. I show up imperfectly all of the time. I'm more talking about the reclamation of care practices for me because of the job that I do, the work that I do, which doesn't feel like a job, the practice I'm engaged in, right? It is work, it is labor. And because of the nature of it, I better be sure I'm taking care of myself in some way and finding those moments, be it 10 minutes of rest or a weekend of rest, or be it accessing the different points of refuge, myself included. I am a point of refuge for myself, but nature is a point of refuge. Community is a point of refuge for me as well. My ancestors are a point of refuge. Teachers have had points of refuge. So I need to have those points of refuge and those practices around rest and whatever other healing practices I engage in to sustain what I do, or I will not be able to do it with integrity. And this is part of what I try to offer in spaces as folks gather together, right? That, and it's what I said at the beginning, you know, healing is the through line for me. And we might heal in different ways, of course, and certainly heal together. And we need to have a practice. I say this all the time to my yoga teacher training students, have a practice. I don't really care what it is. It's like specific to you, but have a practice to ground yourself during an ungrounded time. Like there's so much going on. And the other thing that comes to mind about this is staying in a place of healing. And Rashid talks about this. Lama Rod Owens talks about this and says, you know, if the context is chaos, then consume the chaos in some way so it doesn't consume you, which I love this teaching. It is part of what it means to be alive at this particular time, to be in this soup of chaos. And we need to figure out, how do I look at that? How do I acknowledge it? What is my part in responding to it? Because I can't actually consume all of it, right? But what does it mean? That framing for me lands well around consume it, meaning respond to it, notice it. Chaos is like been going on for a long, long time. And actually, I mean, philosophically, chaos is part of what creates a new beginning. If we like zoom way all the way out, I'm not justifying the chaos I'm deeply heartbroken about, but it's a helpful teaching for me to remember that too, like out of chaos, there's generative energy that can create something new. And I want to focus on what my part is in creating something new and contributing to that generative energy and disrupting the chaos in some way, right? Or working with it in some way so that I can transmute it or transform it into something that is better for us all, and to do that in community with others. So I want to offer that. It's an overwhelming time, and I have made a choice to not be consumed by the overwhelm, because I want to be very clear about what I can do in this lifetime to hold change, to make change, to transform the conditions that are in the way of everyone being able to thrive. And the other piece about the healing and staying in the healing, which is connected to chaos and generative energy and a beginning, right, that can come from chaos, is dreaming, which I mentioned a moment ago in the response to the last question you asked. I mean, part of how we stay in the healing is we believe something can happen from this chaos, right? We believe that it is possible to heal. We believe that we can create something better than what is happening right now. We dream about these things, and our role, as it is connected to creating a better world and being, I would say, better stewards of the planet, that our role is uplifted by this capacity to dream of something other than the chaos that is happening around us. So I feel like that is such a huge practice to stay in the healing, is to know something else is possible. Perhaps there's another way we have been. I believe that there's another way we have been, and we need to be in the process of remembering that So we can dream that into being. So that's how I think about the healing. And I do want to say, because you mentioned rage, anger is part of the healing. Grief is part of the healing. Making space to mourn is part of the healing. Laughter is part of the healing. Food is part of the healing, right? Ritual is part of the healing. Rest is part of the healing. That these, I wanted to name anger in particular because people can feel like it's not part of the healing process, but it is part of the journey, particularly for grieving what we've lost in response to this chaos that is persistent at this time. So that's how I'm thinking about healing and staying in the healing. And for me, I'm kind of like, what other option do I have but to stay in the healing if I am this convicted about changing the world in some way and doing my part? And if I'm this convicted about caring for myself as I show up to do what I would say is my dharma or duty or practice, what I'm meant to do on the planet.
I love how you connected staying in the healing to dreaming, because I often think about the work that I do as envisioning a different future, even as it feels that that future is far away from being experienced, but that a part of us staying in the healing is that we do believe that another world is possible. It's what brings us to this work, right? And certainly the anger, the grief, the harm, you know, catapults a lot of us into change work. But it's always that belief that there's another reality that's possible, that we could eliminate unnecessary suffering, that people don't have to be hungry, that there is an abundance of resources that are available to us. And so this idea of staying in a state of connection to our dreams and to our visions is really resonant for me as we think about healing and staying in that place of what feels good to us. Because I know for myself, and I appreciate you naming the last 5 years. For me, I felt that intensity of the last 5 years in a way that I'm still recovering from. And that there's a way that you can get lost in all that's happened and all that is happening. And how do we carve out these spaces for ourselves personally and collectively to be in a space of dreaming, a space of joy, of even naming what it is that we're experiencing, that we're grieving. And so even that term, right? I had not really thought about being in a place of grief over the last few years because of the intensity of, say, the last 5 years, where there was such demand and it felt like incredible momentum around racial equity and racial justice. And all of that being brought upon by heartbreak and trauma and grief. And that there was this short moment of reckoning, it seems like, that we were having and we were experiencing across the country, and that it felt like we were at this pivot point where we could have the types of conversations that we needed to have across institutions, across communities, across race, gender, class. And in the last 2 years, to feel that sort of closing in, the backlash, the anti-CRT DEI movement, even the Embodied Justice Initiative and this conversation that we're having is a moment of pause that I think is important for us collectively to name what it is that we've been experiencing, to name the trauma, to name the grief, to come together collectively and think about how we are holding ourselves and sustaining ourselves for the work ahead. And you mentioned having a practice to ground, especially in those moments of intensity or those moments of urgency, those crisis moments. And I wonder if you could share a bit more about what that could look like for change makers, especially when you're in a moment, when we're in these collective moments of crises, and maybe there is, we're being called upon more so than before to hold space, practices to help us ground and to not be consumed by the overwhelm.
Yeah, thanks for the question. And I want to, in answering it, acknowledge that often there is none, for those of us who are less proximal to social and institutional power, for Black folks, for Indigenous folks, people of color, people who are marginalized in some way and are holding the ancestral trauma we've been talking about, and also we're in a context where we're told we're not good, we're unworthy, often that we need to produce and work twice as hard. I mean, all of this is going on. I just want to name that there is an unlearning process around our nervous systems and how they've been conditioned to be in a space of urgency all of the time, because of some of what I've named and we've talked about, also because of clearly racial trauma, also because of ancestral trauma, also because of we can form an addiction to the chaos because it feels so darn urgent for us too, right? It's affecting our lives directly and people we love. So I'm not judging that. I am acknowledging that I will answer about a practice, and I will also say often there is a reckoning that people move through because they are going to give themselves permission to pause long enough to take a deep breath, which might be their practice, in a world that does not want Black people mm-hmm. to breathe, and many other people who experience oppression and marginalization, right? That these systems thrive on our breath being extinguished. And so I just want to honor that is a reality. And I also want to honor that we have different choices based on our points of oppression and points of privilege and our access to things or lack of access, which might make that reckoning a little bit more difficult. And I just think I'm thinking about analysis, like we need to understand that, because as I share practices, I'm aware of my points of privilege and what I have access to that others may not have access to in the same way. Mm-hmm. So it's like not a one size fits all. And I want people to know that I'll share these from my experience in my own practice, but also being with others and guiding practice. And also say that practice is deeply personal. I mean, I dream of a world where everyone has what they need to practice in the way they want to practice and in ways that will help them thrive. And there's a connection to you thriving, right? And my own experience of being able to thrive. So there's that. Some practices that I've engaged in for a long time are contemplative practices, meditation, be that a minute or two. And as I think about my mom, Clara, who I called in earlier, my mom would always, she would always have a TV on, and she's probably on right now. She lives in a retirement community and the TV's on most of the time in her apartment. And at night, it would seem like she was falling asleep. She would just be resting her eyes. She wasn't asleep. She was listening to everything that was going on the TV, what I was saying, what my brother was saying to me. And it's only like in the last several years, I've been like, oh, I think she was meditating. Like she was just taking a moment. Sure, it was noisy. And my brother was yelling at me or I was yelling at him and some show was on the TV. And she was taking a moment to pause and go within, even as the world was turning around her and in her space. And so I want to say, like, meditation for me means like sitting in front of my ancestor altar, and I have multiple altars, and sitting on a cushion or lying on my back and meditating, either guided or not. But for my mom, it looked different. And so really a practice for me is about coming into myself, reminding myself of who I am. That happens through meditation, that happens through writing, journaling, that happens through prayer for me, that happens through the ritual of lighting a beeswax candle in my altar as I prepare to practice. That happens through movement in my body, be that yoga, or earlier today, I took my dog Jasper on a walk. It was a beautiful day and I was taking in the bird song and looking at the trees in bloom. And so, you know, practice could look like that as well. Some sort of movement in the body. And this could be for 5 minutes or this could be for 20 minutes or it could be for an hour, as long as people have to practice. Practice is also for me connected to ancestors. The other day I made a cup of coffee for my grandmother who transitioned in 2017 because I heard she wanted a cup of coffee. That's what came to me. And I have her coffee cups from when she was alive. So I made her a cup of coffee and I made an offering to the ancestors. That's a practice too. I pour libations at a tree in my backyard that is connected to my grandmother, Dorothy. Pour libations and offer a prayer, right? And allow those libations to be lifted. That's a practice too, which could happen outside or with a bowl and a vessel of water that we're pouring in, and we're speaking blessings as we pour the water. That could take 5 minutes, that could take 30 minutes, right? It depends on people and their access and what they're wanting to do. Practice looks like not only offerings to ancestors, but tuning in to ancestors and asking for guidance and what I need to know now. Practice looks like gardening for me and touching the dirt. And it definitely means for me is nature is a big healer for me because it reminds me I am nature. So that's practice, right? Is that taking a deep breath outside? Is that looking out the window? That's practice. Something, I mean, I could go on and on, but something to remind us of who we are, that we're in bodies on the planet right now, that we are in fact bigger than our bodies. And when I say that, I mean, I am a divine being connected to source and spirit and my ancestors. That language may be different for someone else, but there's something bigger going on and I am part of it and part of the cosmic unfolding is how I think about it, even if I don't understand what's happening. And I need that practice to help remind me to stay grounded, right? To lean in when it's really difficult to do the work that I and we do and to practice. I could name more, but those are a few things, contemplative practices and movement and mindfulness, anything that brings us home to ourselves, talking to a good friend, going to a community meeting, right? People are part of a faith community, right? There's so many ways we can practice and be reminded of who we truly are so that we can do what we need to do. In the spinning world. So that's a little about practice.
That was such a beautiful invitation to practice, Michelle. Like it was so vivid and colorful. And I loved how you framed practice and meditation that it looks different for each of us. And as you were painting this beautiful picture of the array of options or ways that we could practice, right? I saw myself being able to choose and connect with myself and something bigger in a number of those ways. And so I love that practice is accessible, right? What I heard is that practice is accessible for all of us. It doesn't have to look in the ways that we often have been taught that meditation looks like or contemplation looks like. And so I was imagining your mother, you know, with the TV on and kids around, but still coming into herself. And that felt resonant for me because I think we all have those moments. I think about my grandmother being in the garden and that being contemplative practice for her, or she often had Haitian radio going on in the background. And we knew half the time she wasn't really listening. And that, you know, that was likely a moment of contemplation and practice for her as well. And so I love the invitation for us to call into our ancestors or our elders, because we know they had contemplative practices. And so I think sometimes when I see, you know, an image of a white bodied person meditating, that's often what we see, right? In terms of when meditation is promoted, it doesn't necessarily feel like something I know, but that we have our own cultural expressions and practices of contemplation and of connecting with spirit and with ourselves. And I think, you know, one of the beautiful things aspects of your work is the way in which you integrate ritual and culture in this really accessible way that many of us can see ourselves as being a part of. And so I love us remembering that practice is accessible to us. It's always available to us. It's a few deep breaths. Even as you were talking about the ways that we can practice, I saw and heard you breathe a couple times, and just that remembering that I can take a moment to pause and come back into myself is practice and incredibly healing, I think, for us, often within a context where we don't know. There's a lot of unknowns that's a part of our day-to-day reality. I started our conversation, Michelle, before we hit record by saying that there were so many directions we could go in. You are a prolific author, and that's another conversation that I'd love to have with you in terms of like, how are you creating and producing at the level that you are? But just even our conversation, I can see and feel all that you have to say, and that through practice, you're able to channel these lovely and needed teachings to help us heal collectively. I would love if we could close with you speaking about the concept of sacred activism, although I feel that this conversation has been about, it's been about sacred activism without us even naming it. But I wonder if we could close with, what is sacred activism? If there's anything more you want to share about how our practice of change making and our healing work, our work to heal systems and communities is sacred activism.
Yeah, I love this question. And I think you're right. We've been talking about it all along in so many ways. And the first thing that came to me as I heard your question about sacred activism is, it's actually something I wrote in Finding Refuge. I was writing about my mom when she was sick and we thought was going to transition, and how I had to remind one of the nurses at the rehabilitation space she was in, which she was taken to after the doctors said they couldn't do anything else. And I was not with her physically at the time. I had to remind the nurse of how precious my mom was to me in that moment. I had to be like, my mother, this is my mom. She's precious. That's exactly what I said. She's precious. She needs her medicine. Get her medicine. You know, I was so, and that is what came to me, that image, but also the word, she's precious to me. I think about sacred activism as remembering how precious we are to one another, right? And how precious the beings we are advocating for or in allyship with or being co-conspirators to, whatever language people might want to use or collaborating with to make change. It's because we believe they're precious. They are sacred beings, or we believe the planet is a sacred being, right? All around us and alive. And so when I think about sacred activism, I think about remembering how precious we are to one another, because to me that points to what we are willing to do for one another. It also points to what we talked about, practice and grounding. If I want to sustain this sacred activism, I need a practice to help me come back to myself so that I can stay engaged with integrity and care and practice collective care, which also feels like sacred activism. I think what we talked about related to anger and grief is sacred activism, because that arises from people not treating us as precious beings and us feeling enraged about that and the ancestral memories around that and us responding to those. So I also think sacred activism is connected to what I named about role and doing my part. I can't take care of everything that is happening. It's not humanly possible for me to do that in this lifetime. It may never be possible for me as an individual. I can do my part. It doesn't absolve me of a collective responsibility or responsibility to the collective. It's more that I know that I can't take care of can't put out every fire that is burning right now. And I think sacred activism is remembering that so that I can have clarity about what my role is any particular moment or during a particular time, because role will shift based on the conditions that are in place. That shape-shifting feels like sacred activism to me, and an awareness of that. And also, you know, the practices of calling on or calling in or asking folks to do some healing work before they come back into community, these also feel like practices that are rooted in sacred activism. It is from a place of care that I would call on somebody or call someone in or invite them to deepen their healing practices perhaps in a different space than the community they're a part of because they're replicating harm in that space if they are. So that's what I mean when I say that, to contextualize it. So I feel like sending resources to one another and nourishing one another and being honest and authentic with one another, that's sacred activism too. And the pause that you've named is sacred activism as well. It relates to what I named about role, because we can't take care of every fire that's burning or put them out. I mean, part of this is acceptance around that. Part of it is trust that I will do my part and you will do your part. And part of it is, you know, making that space to grieve when it sometimes feels like it's not enough. But I think remembering that we are enough and we can dream. And I think dreaming is part of sacred activism as well. That unlearning and decreasing the urgency. I mean, we are in urgent times, but can we respond with care and with steadiness and with grace as we face these urgent times? Because often meeting urgency with urgency doesn't actually promote healing. So an awareness of that, and then practices that derive from that awareness, that also feels like sacred activism. So yeah, all of those things. I love thinking about sacred activism and how precious we are to one another.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I love the framing of how precious we are, because I think that's at the root of why we engage in activism, because we appreciate and honor how precious we are. Where can people learn more about you and engage with your healing work, your retreats, your books? Where can we find you?
Yeah, so my website is the best place to find me, which is michellecjohnson.com. And it's updated all the time with offerings, retreats online, in person, trainings or immersions or experiences people could have with me, some shorter than others, right? There are some long form trainings and some shorter immersions and experiences. And that's a good place to find out all of the information and to connect with me if people want to connect. My books are listed there too. And there's one book that may be of particular interest to people listening to this and connected and in your network. I had a book come out in August called A Space for Us, and it's a guide for leading affinity groups for Black, Indigenous, and people of color. And it's from my many years as a racial equity educator, but information about that book is on the website, and an upcoming cohort that will begin in the fall. We're finishing up one now. I'm co-facilitating with my friend Stephanie Ghost and Paul. It's a series based on A Space for Us for folks who want to guide affinity BIPOC or people of global majority affinity spaces, or participate in them or deepen practice around that. So that might be of particular interest. And I have another book coming out in June that is focused in many ways on what we talked about, but it is also focused on spiritual practice, and in particular yoga and Buddhism and the root causes of our suffering and practices that we can engage to decrease our suffering. So that's on the website too. I love being in community with people online and in person, and working with people individually and in group and co-creating community. So there are a lot of different ways to do that.
Wonderful. Thank you, Michelle. This has been such a rich and beautiful, and I would say healing, conversation. You are a gift. Your work is a gift. Mm-hmm. Thank you for being who you are, for blessing us with your presence, with your wisdom, with your teaching. I know we will be connecting again really soon, and I just really appreciate this conversation and looking forward to many more.
Yeah, thanks so much for inviting me here. Thanks for being in the healing in this way and the conversation. And thank you again for the invitation.